Andrew Copeson is the chief executive of the British Humanist Association. He's a former director of the European Humanist Association and currently vice president of the International Humanist and Ethical Union. His writings on humanist issues have appeared in The Guardian, The Independent, The Times, and New Statesman, as well as various journals, and has represented the BHA and humanism extensively in radio and on television. I had the pleasure of meeting Andrew when Roy and I went to London for vacation last September. And turns out that our hotel was on Gower Street, and we found out that the British Humanist Association office is on Gower Street, I thought, well, you know, we're on vacation, but of course we have to stop and see the British Humanist Association and meet Andrew. And we stopped by his office, and he was so wonderfully nice and great. We got to meet the staff of the New Humanist magazine. And we were so impressed, and we were sitting down with Andrew in his office, and we were talking about AHA. You know, we said, you know, we've got one member of Congress, Pete Stark, who's an out atheist and humanist, and we're so very proud of that. And Andrew said, oh, yeah, we have 120 humanists in Parliament. And we're like, oh, that's nice. Of course, we were very jealous, and so I'm so excited to hear more about how this happened, how humanism is such an incredible force in Great Britain. So, welcome. Let's bring up to the stage Andrew Copeson.
Thanks very much. I've entitled my talk, Humanists and Politics, Brackets in Britain, because I want to say something at both the beginning and the end of the talk about a humanist approach to politics more generally. And I don't know necessarily if I've got the content of this presentation right. This is a new audience for me. It's the first time I've even been in this country, never mind about talking about the political situation in Britain to Americans. But I was assured yesterday evening by a very nice young woman that it wouldn't really matter because people will mainly be listening just to my accent for at least the first 10 minutes. So I'm going to try and make it last no more than 11 minutes. Well, obviously human politics arises out of the same necessity as human ethics does. We're social animals, we need to cooperate, and we need frameworks in which to make the decisions that cooperation requires, our communal decisions together. So politics is a necessity for life as human beings. And because we obviously accept that this life that we're living is the only life, at least that we know we have, and there's no future state in which all wrongs will be righted, and the city of God will replace the city of man, and there'll be some sort of transcendent justice for all people, then we also, I think, as humanists, have to be inclined to view politics in another way, not just as a pragmatic necessity, but as really the only medium through which justice and fairness and a civilized standard of common right will ever be achieved, because it's the only medium. My accent thanks you for that. So I want to talk not just in the abstract in that way, but more specifically about the British Humanist Association and the history of the sort of activities that we engage in and how we were brought into the sort of political activity that we do today. Because if the BHA is known for anything in Britain, then it's known for education work, for our ceremonies work, and more widely perhaps, or at least just as widely, for our public affairs and campaigning work, which is very high profile in Britain. Well, this wasn't always the case, and the British Humanist Association, which started in the 19th century, nonetheless had predecessor bodies as far back as the 18th century. But these weren't really politically campaigning bodies. These weren't bodies that had a particular political idea. These weren't advocacy bodies in the modern sense of the word. They were largely concerned, in fact, with social action. So there was communes in the north of England, what we think of them as communes today, in the late 18th century. They thought of them as, you know, model towns or model industrial settlements that were organized along secular lines. And it was about the improvement of people's lives, social action on the individual and local and community-based level. Then in the 19th century, you start to get humanists organizing along political lines for some political ends. But still, it's not too much to do with church and state and with issues of secularism. It's still got quite a lot to do with workers' rights, the rights of women, or social progress more widely. And so the British Humanist Association in the 1900s, by which I mean the 20th century, inherits this 19th century legacy of social action. So the BHA in the first half of the 20th century was running a housing association, was running an adoption agency, was running a counselling service. It was the first humanist counselling service in the world at that point. And they ran those things because, partly because non-religious people didn't have access to those services that the church provided, but also because they saw their role as primarily a role of communitarian and social activism. But that inevitably brings you into political activity. Once you find that your deeply held social views, progressive views that you want to use and advocate to bring the whole of society forward into a more fulfilled way of being, then you find that you have to engage with legislators, with lawmakers to achieve that. And the real flowering of humanist activism in Britain was when the British Humanist Association was a really important active player in a number of campaigns in the 1960s that bore very rapid and snowballing and domino effect of social change. So in 1961 we had the legalisation of suicide. Before that we had the terrible situation where people who had maybe attempted to commit suicide, far from being helped, far from being counselled, would be arrested, which was not ideal. That wouldn't get a laugh in Britain. In 1967, we had the Abortion Reform Act, of course, which legalised abortion in England and Wales and Scotland. In 1967, we had the legalisation of gay sex between men. Two women could always do whatever they wanted because Queen Victoria didn't believe that happened, and so there was never there was never a law against it, or she said she didn't believe it. And then in 1969, the liberalisation of our divorce laws. So throughout that whole decade, there's a rapid pace of social change that is affected by various progressive advocates for social legislation. And the BHA is one of them, quite an active one. People who were prominent in our organisation at the time, people like Bertrand Russell, people like Ian Forster, other prominent humanists involved in the Humanist Association, were also involved in those campaigns. And we see the beginning also of changes in our school curriculum to turn religious and moral education more into an objective study of religions and beliefs, which is incredibly important in producing a balanced and civilised population of the future, and also very good at producing atheists, of course, who, when they compare Hinduism and Christianity and Islam and Judaism, think, you know, it can't all be correct. And apart from just a couple of strange people who think they might all be correct, obviously most people come to the conclusion that none of them are. Well, that was a distraction, so let's carry on. Today, a while on from the 60s, we have two of our six strategic aims of the British Humanist Association to do with public affairs. So the first is this one. Our aim is to arrive at a situation where the UK is a secular state guaranteeing human rights with no privilege or discrimination on grounds of religion or belief. One of my fellow countrymen who is here actually at the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard, James Croft, who spoke earlier in the conference, you may have heard of him, said yesterday that he encountered two views of Britain at this conference, and I've encountered the same. One is that we're some sort of secular utopia, where everyone is completely free of religion and spends every evening watching Fawlty Towers and having... I don't know how that crept in, but that's also come up a lot, so I thought I'd mention it. joyous and uninhibited sex lives, that's also come up a lot. But, you know, generally having fun. But in some ways, we in Britain are still far from having a secular state. And one of the other views of Britain that's come up, the other main view of Britain that's come up when I've been talking to people, is that we're some sort of monarchical, theocratic, semi-third world country. You know, there are two countries left in the world that have clerics in their legislature as of right, and one of them is Iran, and the other, yes, the other is Britain. And it's true that we still do have this sort of medieval rubble in our constitution that needs to be cleared away. We're still in many ways far from being a secular state. But in other ways, we've progressed towards a secular approach. In recent centuries, we've eliminated many civil barriers against non-Christians, and we've moved towards a more equal society. So secularism in the state is one of our aims. And our issues are various. Obviously, we campaign to remove the rights of bishops to sit automatically in our parliament. These 26 men, and of course they're always men, who simply because they've attained distinction in one particular branch and one particular religion, against fewer and fewer competitors each year in their training and their advancement, get to make our laws. We have a third of our public schools, our state-funded schools, are religious in England. And they can employ teachers and other non-teaching staff on the basis of religion. They can admit pupils on the basis of their parents' religion, and they can teach a confessional sort of religious instruction whilst being 100% funded by the state. So that's a big issue for us. We have some issues where the clock is being turned back. At the moment, the hysterical, but seemingly hysterical, but actually frighteningly accurate view would be that the current government and the previous government started this process is beginning to dismantle our social state, the welfare state that we've enjoyed since the post-war settlement. And a lot of these social services have been contracted out, and quite often they're contracted out to religious groups. We all know, all around the world, religious groups love to provide social services, especially if they can do it for cheap, because the money really comes from government, because that's the way to get hearts and minds from people whose tummies are dependent on you through soup kitchens or whatever. And though it might be a crude comparison, there's very little difference really between the Catholic Church and its care homes in England and Hamas and its soup kitchens in Palestine from that point of view, the point of view of how it operates to keep people within religions and alongside of religions. We have the establishment of the Church of England, of course, and we have an illegitimate funding of religious groups. We have a second aim, strategic aim, that touches though on public affairs, and this is separate in a way from issues of secularism, and our aim is also to arrive at a situation where public debate and policy is shaped by humanist perspectives. So that's about humanists having their equal voice in a secular public square, having an opportunity to influence policy in a socially progressive direction in a way that will be better for all people. And our issues there are similar, I'm sure, to the issues we're facing here. We take action on medical and bioethical issues, organ donation, stem cell research, on life and death issues such as abortion and euthanasia, on social justice issues, part of our national coalition to end child poverty in Britain, and many other social justice issues from a humanist point of view, and issues of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law, like, for example, in Britain, defending the right that we've enjoyed for the last 13 years of domestic enforcement of our human rights through our own local national borders, rather than having to go to Europe to do it. Well, this is the less interesting part, really, because lobbying is the same the whole world over. We do our work, we try to achieve these aims through a mixture of partnership with local and national governments, and being recognised as an important part of national life, and a stakeholder, therefore, in the consultative decisions that are made locally and nationally. And we have our place on the advisory councils of the various government departments that deal with issues that we have interest in. Direct parliamentary lobbying, of course, activism locally and nationally, converting our members and supporters into individual lobbyists with their representatives and more widely. The sort of strategic litigation that also goes on here, I know, in the United States, but in Britain is a little cheaper. And coalition working with other organisations, including religious groups, who share our aims. But this is what really, apparently, Maggie and Roy were most excited about when they came to Britain, which is the All-Party Parliamentary Humanist Group. Now, I sounded rather boastful in Maggie's anecdote, actually. I'm sure it happened the other way around. I'm sure that I said, we have 120 people in the Parliamentary Humanist Group, and then she said that there was only one. I'm sure that's how that happened. So let me put the record straight on that one. Our parliamentary unions group began in the 1960s. It is now 120 members in both houses. We have plenty of humanist politicians in Britain. The current leader of our Labour Party is an atheist. The current Deputy Prime Minister of Britain was very involved in his humanist group when he was at university. Michael Foote, who was the leader of the Labour Party. Neil Kinnock, who was the leader of the Labour Party. Winston Churchill, after all, Clement Attlee, many of our 20th century political leaders have been non-religious. It's not that unusual. But the Parliamentary Unionist Group does provide an important network of support for non-religious MPs and peers. It provides sort of networking cross-party for non-religious peers and MPs. And they're also a resource, of course, looking at it more selfishly, for our own lobbying work. And we do have a religious right in Britain. And she's quite a mean woman, and we see her quite often when she's trying to bring the sort of laws that you enjoy here in America to our own country. But she isn't the size of a caucus, she doesn't correspond to the size of the parliamentary unionist group. So it's a very important group for us. Here's commercial. I don't have to go back. I'm having a commercial break now in the middle of my presentation. Well, no, not, you'll be glad to hear the middle, but the last part of my presentation. A commercial break for the International Humanist and Ethical Union. Put your hands up, please, how many of you have heard of, oh, you're going to put your hands together, you can do that later. Is that a hint? Should I give that? If you've heard of the International Humanist and Ethical Union.
Oh, I don't believe that.
No, I do believe it. That's good. Oh, well, I believe you because you're on the board of the International Humanist and Ethical Union. The International Humanist and Ethical Union, the website which you see right there, is an incredibly important organisation. It brings together over 100 national humanist and other non-religious national organisations from over 40 countries to represent humanist concerns at the international institutions, at the United Nations here in North America, the United Nations in Geneva, at the African Commission, the Commission for Human and People's Rights in Africa. It is extremely underfunded. It is largely underknown in national humanist organisations. I'm the Vice President of IHU, as you heard, which is one of the reasons I'm here in America. And I would encourage all of you to give IHU your interest and support. Make a contribution to IHU, which I learned yesterday is a euphemism for money. When I went to the contributors reception, because I thought that a contributor was someone who was speaking at the conference. Which is what it would be in Britain. So I turned up, and then there were all these incredibly generous people instead making contributions of another sort. So we need to, or I hope they will, we need to support international humanists in politics, and we need to support national humanists in politics as well. And that's what the Parliamentary Humanist Group is all about. And this brings us back, I think, to a humanist view of politics. When we say that man is responsible for himself, said Jean-Paul Sartre, we do not mean that he is responsible only for his own individuality, but he is responsible for all men. And thinkers in the humanist political tradition, from Pericles to John Stuart Mill to many mainstream political thinkers today, have seen politics as more than just the necessity that we accepted that it was at the beginning of this presentation, more than just what we have to do to live together in some sort of reasonable condition. Politics is a craft. It's a craft based on what Karl Popper, the humanist philosopher, called reason and humanitarianism. They should be our attitudes, our civic humanist attitudes in politics. It's the medium through which freedom is preserved and sustained, and through which individuals can live with dignity. It's an opportunity to actively preserve and promote the availability of a good life for all people, enabling us to take rational decisions together for a better world, to take personal responsibility, and to develop as people. As I said at the beginning of my talk, for us, it's the only way that will ever happen. So as well as trying to achieve our goals, as well as trying to achieve our public policy outcomes, as well as hoping to see a secular state that will treat all people with equality, I think it's also incredibly important that we recognise and celebrate the participation within that important process, that vital process, the most important process of humanists who are really at the coalface working on our behalf. And with that, point of view. I understand that at least two of those people are going to be speaking to you next, so I'll get out of their way. Thank you very much.